Hello and welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I am Ray Graff. February, did you know, is Financial Aid Awareness Month, and planning for college is the focus of today's program. Certified Educational Planner Lynell Engelmeyer is in the studio this afternoon to talk more about that. As many of us have found, securing an acceptance letter to an institution of higher learning is only half the battle. The other half involves funding the educational experience you hope to have there. We will have more on this from Lynell, who helps us prepare students for these aspects of the college experience. Lynell volunteers to work with underrepresented students through a local and national not-for-profit. She is the author of a college admission and financial aid workbook entitled Moving Forward, What Teens and Parents Need to Know in the Years Leading to College. Also runs a terrific website called College App, APP that is, College App Wizard. com. Always nice to have you here, Lynell. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much, Ray. It's great to be here.
You can call us, and we would love you to call us since it's a call-in program. That would be great. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Or you could tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop. You can post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Facebook wall post. It's facebook.com/WAMC radio. Or you could email us as well, voxpop@WAMC.org. But we love your calls, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. So I must confess, Lynell, I missed the parade. It is Financial Aid Awareness Month.
It
very
was kind
exciting.
Of a small parade.
Yeah. Well, what sort of things can we expect to learn in this month?
You know, I think it's really about awareness. There are so many people out there who I think don't realize either what financial aid is available, how to go about getting it. And so really, this is an effort on the parts of those in the higher ed arena to make sure, you know, that they educate as many people as possible, that there's money out there and that it is obtainable if you do the paperwork.
You know, one of the things that I find so confusing when you are on the program is the circular schedule of when things have to be done, from the acceptance to the financial aid to, you know, your whatever the statement is that shows what your ability to pay is. All
right.
Of that stuff has to be filed at certain times. And it seems to be on this rotating basis, which I find very confusing.
It, particularly because it doesn't really mesh with so much of what you know about life before college. It's kind of a life cycle of its own that doesn't really probably make a lot of sense to people who haven't been through it. And so, for example, you know, in the fall of a student's senior year, most seniors are busy applying to college.
Yeah, I remember that.
You can't actually fill out most financial aid forms. Certainly the biggest one, until after January 1st of their senior year. So then schools will have deadlines by which you must fill it out. So it has to be after January 1st. In some cases, it might be by February 1st, February 15th, March 1st, things like that.
And this is after you've already, and you don't know if you're in yet.
That's correct. So you apply for financial aid after you've applied for college, but before you've gotten an acceptance letter.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you've gotten that acceptance letter, you want, or once they've decided on your acceptance, perhaps even before you've gotten the letter, you want that financial aid office to start working on the package so that by the time you make a decision as to where you're going to go, you know if you can also afford it.
But I mean, it seems to me very difficult for many students who might say, look, in fact, you mentioned to me while we were waiting to go on that applications for somewhat mysterious reasons are down at Harvard and Dartmouth. But it must be strange for those who have no chance, no ability to pay for Harvard, but you're a good student and you apply for financial aid not knowing how much you're going to get. And then you get in and you say, gosh, you know, I can't swing this.
Well, and that is often why you want to do these processes, these application, admission, and financial aid processes in tandem. Because should you do them in tandem and by the specified deadlines, you would presumably have 4 to 6 weeks with both an offer of admission and a financial aid package in your hand to say, okay, can I make this work?
Yeah. You know, because you fill out these forms, and there's a standard one that you talk about on your website that sort of tells you what you can expect you might get, but that doesn't mean you are going to get it, right?
Well, what when you fill out the main financial aid form, which is called, or it's known as the FAFSA, it stands for Free Application for Federal Student Aid, and that's what anyone who wants to get any financial aid must fill out.
Even colleges that just provide their own?
Yes, yes. Okay. This is the main form, and what happens is the result of that is not actually how much financial aid you can get. The result of filling out that form is what the government thinks you can pay. So the result is what we call the EFC, or Expected Family Contribution. So you fill out the FAFSA, and then the government says, we think you can pay, you know, let's say $20,000.
Right.
And your child wants to go to Princeton, for example, and Princeton is somewhere in the neighborhood of $60,000. The $60,000 that Princeton costs minus the $20,000 that the government says you can pay leaves you $40,000 in financial need. It is Princeton's job, or whoever, to meet all or as much of that need as possible. And so filling out the form doesn't tell you how much, the financial aid form doesn't tell you how much aid you will get. That's up to each individual school. But it will tell you, based on a federal formula, how much the feds think you can pay.
Okay. And I know I've asked this question before, but I ask again, when you apply to Princeton and you need $40,000 to cover your tuition, et cetera, does the application, does the admission part of it, the admissions office, know that Ray can't afford much?
So technically, no. And technically, at a place like Princeton, the answer is different than it might be at some other places.
Mm-hmm.
But Princeton and all of the Ivies are what we call need-blind schools. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that means they will admit you without any regard to your ability to pay. The Ivies have made a commitment that they will meet need for students that apply. So whether you can afford to pay $60,000, $30,000, or zero, if you're good enough to get into a Princeton, a Cornell, a Columbia, they will give you what you quote-unquote need according to the federal government.
Hmm.
And when I say quote-unquote according to the federal government, it is because, and I often tell parents, when you fill out the FAFSA, it is what the government thinks you can pay. It is not necessarily what you think you can pay. But for example, if you have a very low income student and they have a zero EFC, which means that your family can pay zero,
mm-hmm,
at a place like a Princeton, I'll just keep picking up Princeton since I started down that road, then Princeton says, okay, we will fully fund you to the tune of $60,000. Not all schools have the ability financially to do that and will not make that commitment. So I'm not going to pick on anybody locally.
It's fun. No, don't.
It's mostly private schools that have large sums of their own institutional funding that can give out more money and come closer to meeting that need. But not all of them can do that. For example, I'll go out of area on this one. Drexel University, right, and the University of Pennsylvania, both in my hometown of Philadelphia, are right next to each other. The University of Pennsylvania, as an Ivy League institution, has made a commitment to meet your full need.
Mm-hmm.
Drexel University, because of the size of their endowment, which is not that of an Ivy League institution, has not made that commitment because they can often not afford it. It doesn't mean they will not meet your need. It means they may not meet your need. And so what happens is, in your case, you play hurry up and wait. And you have to wait and see, can schools meet your need? Who meets all of your need? Who meets it in the best forms of aid possible? Because not all forms of aid are created equal.
Right.
And so really, you end up sitting around and waiting until you get every financial aid package from every school, until you can lay them out across the kitchen table and compare not only the bottom line of each package, but the component parts.
Is there an advantage then to early application, early admission?
Yes and no. In terms of admissions, there are some advantages. There are some schools that will tell you off the bat that your odds of getting in are better in the early decision pool. An early decision is a binding commitment.
Mm-hmm.
So you apply to my school, I accept you, you agree to come here, and you pull all your other applications.
Okay, but you would know earlier, then you could pull your applications earlier.
Yes, you could pull your applications earlier, and the vast majority of those schools will give you the benefit of an early financial aid estimate. Mm. They will ask you to fill out a secondary form, either their own institutional form or what's called the CSS profile, which is an arm of the College Board. And it will allow you, even though you can't fill out the FAFSA because it's not after January 1st yet, it will allow you to get an estimate.
Mm. Lynell Engelmeyer is our guest, and we have Lynell on every 6 months or so because this, as I say, this whole process of applying for college, applying for financial aid is on this grand circular calendar now, and so it always seems to be appropriate to have Lynell on the program. The number to call is 800-348-2551. It's 1-800-348-2551, and I promise you we'll get to your calls as soon as we take this very brief break.
Support for WAMC comes from Smith College Museum of Art, presenting The Eye is a Door, landscape photographs by Ann Whiston Spurn, now on view. Exhibition-related programs and more, smith.edu/artmuseum for details. Kingsway Community Schenectady, New York, offering a continuum of care and services to area seniors since 1975, including assisted living and more, caring in the family tradition, 518-393-8800. And Kern Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York. Legal and consulting services on regulatory issues for life insurance and annuity manufacturers and distributors. KernCompliance.com.
Lovely, lovely music. It's Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. Lynell Engelmeyer is our guest. Let's go to Lynn in Ware. Thanks for waiting, Lynn. You're on.
Hi. I hope I can explain my question clearly.
Okay.
I'm looking towards the future when our daughter will go to college, which is like 5-6 years from now. And we used to have a fair amount of money, comfortable. And for a variety of reasons, that's no longer the case. I'm sorry. I just want to turn off my own radio.
That's a good plan.
And so we have two houses. We live in one house where we have, like, no equity. And we have another house that we rent out for the income. And we have a lot of equity in that house. And what I'm wondering about is, and those are, that's pretty much the only asset that we have. So, and our income, it doesn't meet our expenses any longer. So what I'm wondering is how is it likely that colleges or the federal government would look at that asset? And is there any planning that we should start doing ahead of time? Does it look at it differently if the house is owner-occupied or if we get rental income from it? Also, we're older parents, so when all of this starts happening, we'll be in our early to mid-60s.
So that actually, I'm really glad you put in that last part about your age, because a couple things you should know about the federal formula. Number one, the formula is income heavy. It will weigh your income heavier than it will weigh your assets, significantly so in the case of parental assets. The other thing that will happen with assets is that there's what's called an asset protection allowance, and it is based on the age of the older parent. So the closer you are, or either one of you are, to retirement, the more of your assets they're likely to protect. Mm. For the federal aid purposes, the equity in your primary residence will not be counted. Okay, they won't ask. However, your rental property will be an asset. And what they will ask you for is the net value of that. So, you know, the fair market value of it, if you were to sell it today, minus any debt against that, will be the value of that rental property. And then they will take a percentage of that, less the asset protection allowance, to include in your contribution. Now, some of it really depends on what is the value of the house. You know, obviously, a $300,000 house and a $750,000 house are two very different houses that will have two very different net results.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if your daughter applies to a public institution, so, you know, in your case, UMass Amherst, or even, say, Penn State or the University of Michigan, state schools, generally speaking, use only the free application for federal student aid. So they would, in any case, never ask you the value, the net value of your primary residence. If she applies to a private institution, you know, a lot of the schools in the Boston area, for example, they will ask for a secondary financial aid application called the CSS profile, which asks a lot more detailed financial questions. They will, in fact, ask you the equity in your primary residence. What I can do, and really the best answer I can give you as far as planning is concerned, is to direct you to a website that I think is probably, you know, other than the one Ray mentioned that I came up with, but really in the financial aid world, I think the best repository of financial aid information is FinAid, F as in Frank, I-N like Nancy, A-I-D.org. It is a very, very reputable place to go for financial aid information, and even for me, with somebody who's got years of experience, it's still my go-to resource. On the homepage, you will see a link that says calculators. If you click on that, there's another link that says EFC, or Expected Family Contribution Calculator. If you do that calculator, it will tell you and it will break down for you what portion of your contribution will be from your income, what portion of your contribution will be from your assets, from your daughter's, things like that. And so what you can then do is go through and play out different scenarios. So, for example, if you said, okay, well, we'll sell the house. Well, we'll take a home equity loan against the house. You can play out all of those different scenarios with that calculation, and it will show you the result. And it will give you basically kind of a mock or dummy EFC, but in my experience, it's pretty spot on.
Great. Lynn,
wow, that's very helpful. Can I ask a follow-up question?
Very quickly.
Okay. So if we were to transfer, you know, stop living in one house and live in the other, do you know how far back they look? Like, when does the house start to count as owner-occupied or primary residence?
Usually, most of the questions on the financial aid forms are geared at answer the question as of today. So, for example, one of the questions is, how much money do you have in cash, checking, and savings? And when they ask that, they ask it as of the day you fill out the form. So I always tell people, you know, if your mortgage payment is due tomorrow, either pay the bill today or fill out the form tomorrow. But so that is what I'm guessing. The CSS profile, and I know that's the case on the FAFSA, for the CSS profile, for some tax information, they will actually ask you tax information from one or two prior years, depending on the situation. So I would have to actually look at that to see what the specific housing look back is. But, I mean, it's maybe a year or so, if that. I would actually have to think about the answer to that one for a second. But on the FAFSA, it's as of the day you fill out the form.
All right, Lynn, we got to move it on. But thank you very much for the call. 1-800-348-2551. Matt in North Adams is next. Hi, Matt. You're on.
Oh, hey. So I'm actually currently a student. I'm at MCLA. And so the problem that I have is that sort of I'm in this weird hole where I can't really get a lot of aid because ostensibly my folks can more or less afford college, so the only real aid I get is a loan. And the problem is, like, you know, like, it's impossible to get a job on campus because all the work-study kids, all of, you know, the people who have that built into their aid get all of those, you know, jobs and things. So for me, you know, I'm stuck with, you know, paying like a, you know, I'm going to have a pretty big loan when I graduate, you know, in a year or two. And so I'm just trying to figure out the best way to, you know, have my finances in order so that I can be paying off my loan as I go forward.
So a couple things to know. Matt, can I ask you how old you are?
Yeah, I'm 21. I'm a junior.
Okay. So there's a difference between, there's a couple different scenarios that I've run into. You know, I've had some parents who will say, you know, we are choosing not to help you because we think college is your responsibility, and that's one instance. There's another instance where on paper your parents might look, you know, fairly okay financially, but the reality of the situation is that there is something going on financially that doesn't necessarily reflect itself on the FAFSA that nobody may know about that is affecting your parents' ability to pay. If it is an arrangement between you and your parents and a decision between you and your parents that they are not going to, for whatever reason, contribute, that is probably a situation that not many schools are going to make exception for. Because, you know, honestly, if I said to you, oh, Matt, your parents aren't going to pay, all right, let me give you a little extra aid, then everybody would say
right.
that. The flip side is if the FAFSA and the financial aid forms are really an attempt to put every American family on a level playing field. Not every American family plays on that level playing field. And sometimes if you take the time to express that situation to them, you will get a very different response from the school, even if it just means willingness to insert work study in there. The federal nonprofit that are the national nonprofit, rather, that I work with, I was on the phone with one of the students over the weekend, and she lives in Honolulu. So after my rage of jealousy over the weather, one of the things that came out of it was that her parents make what in upstate New York would be a reasonable salary. However, on Honolulu, where a gallon of milk is well in excess of $6, that same amount of money on Honolulu does not go nearly as far. And so what would be robust here is not there. And there were one or two other things going on. And I said, look, let's write a letter to the financial aid offices in question. I can't guarantee what they'll do, but at least they then have the prerogative to make a change on her behalf. And so what I would ask you to look at is there more to the story than the financial aid office knows about? And if you say yes to that, then I would consider putting it in writing to the financial aid office. They're going to make you put it in writing, and that's a federal requirement, using as specific a dollar amount as possible. If that is not the case, then what I would say to you is, as you come closer and closer to graduation, you should certainly be looking at federal loan consolidation.
All right. Matt, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Linnell Engelmeyer is our guest. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. You know, it's Financial Aid Awareness Month. So we'll have a parade a little later down Central Ave.
Soon, very
soon. Okay, this is great. 800-348-2551 is the number. And Susan in the Berkshires, you're on.
Hello. I understand that there are certain things that you should be looking at about getting your financial ducks in a row before your student finishes their sophomore year
of high school.
And so I'm just wondering, what are those? What should I be looking at, and how should I be getting my ducks in a row?
Well, you know, there's not a magic bullet answer to that, because obviously, again, like the last caller, if there was, everybody else would be doing it. How I will answer your question, Susan, is I will tell you how the formula works, and from there you can deduce what you might want to do. As I said to the first caller, the formula is income heavy for you. Okay. However, it will still always take a much smaller portion of your income and assets than it will your high school child's. Okay. So, for example, let's say is this a son or a daughter?
Son.
Okay. So, let's say your son has a job. And the way the federal formula treats his job is that the first $1,750 of his income is not assessed for financial aid purposes. However, it takes half of everything over that. Okay, so that's the first thing you should know.
Okay.
The second thing you should know is that of the assets that are in his name, they will take, it's somewhere around 20-25% of his gross assets right off the top. Whereas for you, they take your assets, they take a series of allowances against your assets, like the asset protection allowance I talked about earlier, which is a function of the age of the older parent. Mm-hmm. And they then take no more than somewhere around 8 or 10% of your assets. Okay? So your assets and his assets are treated very, very differently.
Got it.
So that's the other thing.
So does that mean then your child should not be working the year before application? In other words, you know, a kid might deliver pizzas, let's say,
mm-hmm.
and make $7,000, mm-hmm. let's say, and after $1,700, half of that goes on the form. So what's the advantage then of having the kid make a little chump change delivering pizzas?
Well, and it does start to become a slippery slope, and you've hit on it exactly, Ray, is that becomes a question you then have to address. And, you know, that's something that I think each family needs to address individually. But it can have a big impact and is probably a decision you should make purposefully. Now, I will tell you that a lot of schools, particularly schools that give away a lot of their own institutional funding, will have what they call a minimum student contribution. So if your son never works a day in his life and has no assets, there are a fair number of particularly private institutions that will say to your son, you have to contribute a minimum of, say, $1,600, which is a good ballpark. They hover in there somewhere. Some are a couple bucks more, some are a couple bucks less. But some schools, many schools will say they have a $1,600 minimum student contribution. So even if your son has never worked, then they're still going to assume that he can contribute that $1,600. So it's a good discussion that to have, but I think it's one that has to sort of be decided within the confines of your own home.
Interesting. Susan, thank you very much for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Linnell Engelmeyer is our guest. Jordan in Kingston, you're next. Jordan, go. Let's hit the button again. Jordan, you're next. Go.
Because I know a lot of the scholarships, or no, not scholarships, financial aid that's available, it can be as high as 6 or 7%. Now, I'm wondering if you go to a school like Princeton and with $60,000 a year and the family can't contribute anything, but Princeton goes, yeah, we'll give you $60,000 to come to this school at a, part of that's going to be at 6% interest, 5% interest, and so on. You know, where does the school, does the family income or the family capability to pay for the college affect the interest rate of the financial aid?
And the answer to that is no, it doesn't. But I'm going to back up a second and go back to one of the details in your question. If I took your scenario, Jordan, and I said, okay, my family has an expected family contribution of zero. We can contribute absolutely nothing. All of the Ivies, for a very interesting reason, or at least partly for an interesting reason, will not give that zero EFC kid loans. Okay, that is their commitment to lower income students. Okay, so in that specific scenario, it wouldn't happen. However, let's go to a school that's not an Ivy and that would ask that zero EFC kid to take a loan. The answer is still no. The interest rate on the loan is not a function of either A, your family's income, or B, your income upon graduation, because the loan is a federal loan. And so the interest rate on the loan is federally set. It could theoretically go as high as 8.25%. It is an annual interest rate set each year, somewhere right around July 1st, based on the T-bill rate right around then. And it is federally set, but will never go above 8.25%. Now, what happens in your scenario, let's say you want to be a social worker, which is traditionally a lower paying field. There are what are called graduated repayment options, such as an income contingent option. So as you go to enter repayment, if you're in that situation, you may want to start looking at an income contingent repayment option.
Awesome. Do you know if there's anything for teachers? I'm trying to go to master's school too, or graduate school to get a teaching degree. And it's just, teachers don't make the millions either.
Exactly.
But I'm going to come out with a lot of debt. So
exactly. And actually, there is. It is specifically for teachers who work in certain low-income, either highly urban or highly rural areas. Then those teachers will be eligible. And in that case, it's actually not income contingent repayment. It is a loan repayment option where for every X number of years you teach in that low-income district, they will repay a certain portion of your loan.
Wow, thank you.
Yeah, Jordan, thank you.
Good
so
luck.
Income contingent rates, so if you were a poet and you made nothing, then you'd be all set, right?
Well,
so
not actually.
Poetry, yes?
Not actually all set. You still have to repay the loan.
Oh.
What they do is the standard repayment term for a student loan is 10 years. It can stretch under these income contingent options to something around 20 or 25 years, which after your 25 years, if you've been timely and current for all of your payments, there are then scenarios where they will forgive what's left of the loan. So looking at 25 years of repayment, I'm not really sure makes it all that appealing.
Okay, so reasons for poets to be optimistic. Joanne in Saratoga Springs. Joanne, you're on with Linnell Engelmeyer.
Hi, thank you so much for being there today. My son is currently a student in a local community college, and he's in his last semester. So going forward, of course, he needs to go on to a four-year school. He has not chosen one yet,
mm-hmm.
and listening, it's like that probably should have been something he's already done, or is it different once you're in the community colleges?
So it is a little bit different because he is now technically a transfer student, and oftentimes admissions deadlines for transfer students are later than they are for first-time freshmen. So, for example, if you look at Union or Skidmore, their application deadline for first-time freshmen is somewhere between January 1st and January 15th. For transfer students, it will be a later deadline. However, you probably want to be in a position right now where you are finding out what those deadlines are so that you can plot them on a calendar and plan accordingly and not miss any of them.
Okay.
Well, one other thing, I know he won't finish at the end of this semester. He is dyslexic, so therefore he's been taking classes since before every semester and between every semester, mm-hmm. like winter breaks, the summer breaks,
mm-hmm.
even before his very first semester after he got out of high school. So therefore, he didn't have to take so many credits and could still do well in them. He's got a really nice average, but he had to take it in smaller bites. So therefore, he's technically not going to graduate until he takes his summer classes.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to make a difference?
Probably not, because if he graduated in, say, August, and then he was going to start at a four-year institution in September, I think as long as they know that he will graduate before he starts there, you should be fine. But it's something I would communicate to the institutions itself. I don't see that as being a huge sticking point. And tell your son good for him for gritting it out.
Joanne, thanks very much for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 800-348-2551. More calls. We hit the home stretch with Linnell Engelmeyer coming up.
Support for WMC comes from the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting the exhibition Ogden Pleissner, Watercolors and Oil Paintings, February 15th through June 1st, arkellmuseum.org. Sunflower Natural Foods Market, Woodstock. Chocolates and sweets, body oils, lotions, gift sets, candles, and local goods for Valentine's Day on Facebook, Twitter, and sunflowernatural.com. And Veterinary Emergency and Specialty Hospital, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, providing ophthalmology, surgery, and internal medicine services for dogs and cats, now offering laser eye surgery, VESHDeerfield.com.
Fox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. And Tim in Gilderland, you're next.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm wondering if, say, your child gets accepted to college this spring in April and you get a financial aid package that's okay, but your family is going to be stressed out through loans and everything else, but you decide to go ahead and go to that college, and then maybe wait a couple of months, would it make sense for you to go back to the financial aid office and say, listen, you guys have budgeted $2 million for financial aid. You cannot possibly have used all of it because there are kids who get accepted at that college and they turn it down, so that financial aid money is just sitting there. Can't you go back to that financial aid office and say, listen, I need this now, and can you allocate that rather than let it sit there?
I see where you're coming from with your thinking, but let me tell you what happens is a school has historical data to know how many of the students that they offer admission to will enroll there. That's called the yield rate. Okay, so for example, let's say a school like Union knows that for every student they admit, maybe 40% of them will enroll. They give out or they offer far more financial aid money than they have. So If you said, let's say they had a $2 million financial aid budget, they will offer significantly more than that, knowing that only about 40% of the kids will accept it. So it's a little bit of an art and a little bit of a science. So
it's also a gamble. What if they're wrong?
It's a huge gamble. You bank on that historical data, and it's not always spot on. So there will be times where you've overshot your budget. There will be times where, Tim, like you said, perhaps they've underdone it, though that doesn't generally happen. My suggestion to you would be, rather than waiting until the summer where, you know, if they come back to you and say, nope, sorry, really, all the money's gone, then you have no other recourse. My suggestion to you would be to think about, I spoke, I think it was to the first caller, about going on to finaid.org and figuring out what your EFC is, or alternately, more importantly, when you submit the FAFSA, it will tell you what your expected family contribution is. The school prepares a financial aid package, and they may or may not have met all of your need. Let's say the school has not met all of your need, okay? There might be a $4,000 or $5,000 gap, for example, between your financial need and what that school offered you. My suggestion would be to go back to that school sooner rather than later and say, you know, my child really wants to come here. If it's his first choice school, let them know that. However, we need you to come closer to meeting full need to make that a reality. And again, if there are any extenuating circumstances that affect your ability to pay that haven't been reflected elsewhere, this is a really good time to tell them, because if you're asking them for more money, you might want to give them a reason why, if there is one. But one reason is you didn't meet our full need, and it's just not doable for us.
And all this is done in writing?
It's always done in writing. And the reason for that is because the school has what's called the professional judgment to make a change. But in order to do that, they must document it, because they're giving out so much of the federal government's money that the federal government will inevitably at some point come in and audit them.
Yeah.
And having it in writing in your file allows the federal government to see that the change that the school potentially makes is a legitimate one based on documentation.
All right, Tim?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's go to David in New Paltz. Hi, David, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for doing a good job there. Listen, my neighbor's son went to Yale Law School. And they have a reputation of everybody that graduates from Yale Law School gets a job. But for the past 3 years, jobs have not been available. And the lawyers who have graduated are banding together to sue the college because they were guaranteed jobs when they graduated. So it seems that if they win, that there might be a program put together that you can go to school on the IOU, that you get a job, and a portion of that money that you were trained for, and when you get that job, goes towards paying off your education. So when you have money coming in, then you could pay it off.
I'm actually familiar with what you're talking about, and I think that it may be happening somewhere other than Yale as well, where students are saying, you know, that there was sort of an implied commitment of employment, you know, and I don't know what's going to happen with it because it's a very, very tough job market. And, you know, the other thing, too, is what constitutes employment after law school and what constitutes employment in the field. So I think it's not a very cut and dry case. And I'll be curious to see what happens with it.
Also, a lot of students are going to school and taking out debts to get training to work for a company. And when they graduate, whatever training they have is already obsolete. And they're saying that in the past, the companies paid for training for people to be trained.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've transferred all that responsibility onto the colleges to train people for them and at the expense of the federal government and the individual student. What do you have to say about that?
That one I'm not quite as familiar with. You know, a lot of companies that want students specifically with a four-year degree, generally speaking, are not looking for very, very specific skills. So, for example, if you go to school for accounting and I am General Electric, I'm going to assume that you know the basics of accounting, but I am also going to assume that the onus is on us to teach you what you need to know about General Electric and accounting. So I can't really comment too much on that because I'm not quite as familiar with it.
But if you go to school for computer science and technology is changing so fast that after 4 years, everything you learned is obsolete already.
Yeah.
And even if you graduate and you have you're out of work for 6 months, you're obsolete already.
Yeah. Well, you get your point. Hey, Dave, we're going to move it along, but thank you very much. Let's go to Sandy in Cahoes. Sandy, thanks.
Hi, Ray. My question is about when filling out the financial aid forms and things like that, a lot is on the parent's income, but my income is based on substituting or based on, like, I do rec softball or I do reffing for football. Those incomes are, we'll call them consultantship incomes. You know, I don't know if I'm going to get called to sub today or not, so I have no specific steady check. And 1 year I could make $600 or another year I could make $10,000. It depends on whether or not teachers are sick.
So you apply when you have $600, right?
Yeah. I'm sick when that happens. But you know, the fact of the matter is that when my daughter will be graduating next year, and I'm just concerned that I don't have a way of showing any kind of steadiness to my income.
And so what I would do in a situation like that is, so she will graduate in...
Junior. She's a junior.
She's a junior now.
She's a junior this year in high school, yeah.
So what you will have to report 2014's income when she applies. That's what you're going to have to report. Let's suppose that 2014 is a fabulously robust year in the world of your consulting.
Knock, knock, knock.
Right, exactly. however, the 2013 was not, and you have the expectation the 2015 might not be. You have to use 2014 on the FAFSA, but what you can do is you can then, again, write a letter to the financial aid office. And what I would do in your case, Sandy, is use some historical data. So go back and you may be using 2014, but go back and look at 2012 and 2013 and say, look, 2014 was a really good year, but it was X dollars higher than the two prior years. And that is, you know, that's about what your average is. It's always the institution, the individual institution that has the ability to make any kind of changes and not the feds. When you submit the FAFSA, you give them what they ask for and only what they ask for with no explanations.
So it's just right. So it's just on, I'm just going to be putting my whatever line, the 1040, you know, kind of thing, and that's it. But send the letter along to the school and say, hey, I know what that says, but this is the reality. And that's just as equal to what everybody else is talking about, where they have the steady paycheck, as it is to mine, where I have no idea what I'm making this week, let alone this year.
Exactly. Okay. And then what I would do is, you know, as a financial aid administrator, I can't really make a change based on, I don't know what it's going to look like, but if you say to me, I don't know what it's going to look like, however the two prior years look like X and Y, and you give me some kind of number to go by, I can make a change then.
All right, Sandy, thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Beth in Williamstown. Beth, you're on.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I hope this isn't beyond the scope of today's discussion. But,
oh, Linnell knows all. You'll be fine.
Thanks for the vote of confidence.
My daughter graduated a little less than a year ago from college, and between the loans that she took out and the Parents PLUS loans that we took out, there's a combined total of close to $100,000 in debt. The college she went to was great, but education is just too expensive these days. We probably should have chosen a state school. In any event, I know about income-based repayment options for the loans she took out. She's now teaching overseas and may or may not be able to take advantage of some extended repayment terms and so forth. But for the Parent PLUS, it doesn't seem to be anything. you know, we're paying the equivalent of a second mortgage just to repay her loans, and I suppose we should have thought of this 5 years ago and not today, but I'm glad that we made the decisions we made. It was a wonderful experience for her. I just wonder if you have any advice for those of us on this end of things.
You know, unfortunately, not so much. The only possible thing I could think of is to look at whether some type of debt against your home to pay off the PLUS loan would have more positive, would have more benefits to you, such as the tax deductibility of the interest and things like that, and potentially a lower interest rate. Off the top of my head, that's the only thing I can think of, though a financial planner may have other answers for you. But I think the debt against your home, if you're in such a situation to allow that, is at least worth examining.
And remember, this is, you know, a suggestion, and you should really consult a professional and do your homework on that.
Of course, but you're talking about like an equity line, a second mortgage or something like that.
That's what I'd at least look at and examine.
Okay, well, I appreciate your insight. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Beth, thanks a lot. Here's one from email. Scott in Boston Spa says, my kids have graduated from college with low debt. My son teaches in a small, rural, impoverished school district. Are there options for loan forgiveness? My daughter went to a fancy school and has more debt. She's working at an average job making around $30,000. Are there any options for her to get forgiveness or reduce her owed debt? Thanks for your suggestions, and thanks for the email, Scott.
There are income or loan repayment options for people who teach in or who serve in low-income districts. Again, those are usually either very urban or very rural.
Right.
You know, and it's not just for teachers. There are for people who have gone through medical school. If you serve in a low-income community, there can be some debt repayment options. Honestly, I think the best way to find out about those would be either through the website I mentioned earlier, which was finaid.org, or just through Googling, you know, teacher student loan repayment options.
All right, how about the daughter who went to the fancy school and has lots of debt but has an average job, about $30,000?
You know, if you're not, as far as loan repayment goes, if you're not serving in an underserved community, there's really, you know, that's the big way to get the loan repayment done. The other thing that I would look at, again, are things like, you know, income contingent repayment, graduated repayment, or loan consolidation.
Okay. Well, that's great. Let's go to the phones. Sharon, where are you calling from? Oh, it's Carol. Hi, Carol. You're in South Hadley?
Hi, Carol. It's Carol.
Hi. Hi, Ray. I'm Ray. You're Carol. Now we've got to sort it out.
I'm sorry, Ray.
You're all set.
I love WAMC.
Thanks.
I have just two quick questions. One was, my husband passed away, and my daughter's a junior, and she's going to be receiving some Social Security benefits. If we do apply for financial aid, will those be placed into play, as you were talking about a child's money in their accounts?
So, yes, Social Security benefits would be, and it's a good question that you pose, because Social Security benefits would be counted as part of her money. However, and I don't know about this case specifically, but usually Social Security benefits for a child end at age 18. And normally that happens sometime in the year that you're actually applying for financial aid. So what happens was you're reporting the amount of Social Security you got in the last full calendar year, knowing full well you're not going to get that in the next calendar year because it ends when she turns 18. So let's say for sake of argument that she will have gotten $10,000 in Social Security benefits during 2014. But let's say she turns 18 in March, okay? She's only going to get 3 prorated months of that. But it's going to look like she got a whole year because that's what you have to report. What you want to do in a situation like that, again, is write to the financial aid office at each individual school and tell them essentially what you just told me, you know, that her father passed away, that you've been getting Social Security benefits, that they will end on her 18th birthday, which is on whatever date. And through that time, she will have accumulated, you know, X dollars for the current calendar year.
Okay.
And then what they should be able to do is have the professional judgment to cross out the $10,000, put the new amount in, and figure that in. But it's only the school that can make that adjustment.
Carol, we got to go, but thank you very much for the call. And thanks to everybody who called in today. We're just about out of time. Liddell Engelmeyer, a splendid job once again. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's College App Wizard. That's APP, collegeappwizard.com. Support comes from the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, protecting New York's historic buildings, districts, and landscapes since 1974. PreserveNYS.org. Interim Healthcare, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day so you or a loved one can stay in your home. Serving the Capital Region, Columbia County, Glens Falls, and Saratoga, interimhealthcare.com. And Performance Automotive Pittsfield, a European and Saab service center serving Western Massachusetts and the greater Albany market for 25 years. Saab, it's not just a car, it's a passion. SaabPerformance.com. Thanks again for being with us on Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at WAMC Vox Pop on Twitter and Facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Our engineer, Zach Malloy. Your calls answered by Colleen O'Connell. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Vox Pop, well, it might have been plumbing. It might have been birds. It depends on the snow. We might just shoot the breeze. Who knows? We'll find out. Tune in.